This is the Partners for Progressive Israel webinar. Does Netanyahu's new government spell the end of democracy in Israel? We'll start it in just a second. Okay, we're live on Zoom, we're live on Facebook Live, so we're gonna get started. The name of the webinar you've reached is Does Netanyahu's New Government, and that's a government that we expect to see take power next week, does it spell the end of democracy in Israel? I just wanna say hi to everyone in the US, Israel, Palestine, other places in the world, folks are joining us. We are in the week of Hanukkah, so I wanna wish Chag Sameach to everyone out there who believes in banishing the darkness. This is the latest in Partners for Progressive Israel's webinar series called Conversations with Israel and Palestine. My name is Ron Skolnick. I organize these webinars on behalf of the organization. Before I hand things over to today's discussion moderator, I'll note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit. It's dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and that includes an end to Israel's military occupation. Partners supports Israelis working to ensure social justice, civil rights, Jewish-Arab partnership, and equality for all of Israel's inhabitants. The organization seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's and Palestine's complexities in order to better advocate for a progressive future for all inhabitants of the region. Partners is glad to be bringing this webinar for free, but if you enjoy it, enjoy the type of programming, then please visit progressiveisrael.org and make a contribution before the end of the year. And just one other quick note about upcoming programming. On Sunday, January 8th, Partners for Progressive Israel is going to be holding the last two of its sessions of its online Israel-Palestine symposium. And those sessions are dedicated to the question of human rights, education, and miseducation, and a session about where do we go from here, which is sort of a wrap-up session. You can find details at progressiveisrael.org, and there'll also be a direct link in the chat to learn more about those two sessions. One other thing, the chat and the Q&A are both open. The chat is open for just general conversation amongst the audience. It's not going to be monitored in terms of people seeking to pose questions. People who want to ask questions, they should do so in the Q&A, in the Q&A alone. So now let me introduce our panel today. Mirav Zonshine is an Israeli-American journalist and commentator who's covered Israeli politics and U.S. foreign policy for over a decade. Her work has appeared in such publications as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New York Review of Books, The Guardian, The Nation, a lot more that I won't include here. She's a founding editor of 972 Magazine, a contributor to Jewish Currents. And since January of 2021, she's been the senior analyst on Israel-Palestine for the International Crisis Group, where she's responsible for covering Israeli domestic politics, relations with the Palestinians, and regional conflict settings and policies. Mirav's co-panelist is Sally Abed. Sally is an elected member of the National Leadership of Standing Together, which is a grassroots movement that mobilizes Jewish and Palestinian citizens in Israel. In recent years, Sally has become a prominent Palestinian voice in Israel, advocating progressive causes for social and climate justice, and highlighting their connection to the struggle for peace and end to the occupation, through building a new majority, and I would say a new type of majority in Israeli society. Sally is the co-host also of Groundwork, and that's a podcast series about Palestinians and Jews who refuse to accept the status quo and are working together for change. Last but not least, today's moderator is Deir Abu Ras. He is a PhD candidate at the Department of Government Politics at the University of Maryland and a graduate assistant at the Guildenhorn Institute for Israel Studies, where he researches Jewish political identity in Israel. Deir holds an MA from the University of Houston and a bachelor's from the University of Haifa, my own alma mater, though at different times. a Palestinian citizen of Israel. Baer worked both in civil society and government, focusing on equal employment opportunities for the Arab community, as well as advocating for greater civic rights for minorities in Israel. Okay, with the bios having been shared, let me hand things over to Baer. I'll be back at the end to wrap things up. And in the meantime, enjoy the webinar.
Thank you, Ron. Good afternoon to those of you in North America. Good evening to those of you in Israel and around the world. Chag Sameach, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. May we always meet in these renewed spirits of happy days. My name is Tahar Abu Ras, and I'll be serving as the discussion moderator for the next 60 minutes. For about the first 40 minutes, I'll be posting the questions to the panelists, but after that, we'll be answering questions from the video audience for about 20 minutes or so. I encourage all of you to type in your questions at any time. All you need to do is look to the bottom of your monitor for the icon that reads Q&A. Please note that viewers' microphones are turned off and questions can only be asked when typed in this way. So with that, I suggest we begin, since we have a lot on our plate. A lot has been said about the last elections, and many want to know about the ramifications of these elections. And so I'd like to begin actually with Mehrav. So basically every election, and we know this not only from Israel, but also in the United States, also in the UK following the Brexit vote, there's always this, we always hear the losing side talking about leaving the country, that they are disappointed in the political system. They feel that they are not represented, their values are not represented. And there's just this general feeling of giving up. But usually what usually happens is that, you know, the losing side complains maybe for a few days or a few weeks, and then everybody moves on with their lives. The opposition returns to being an opposition. Everything, you know, life continues, and come the next elections and you might get a different result. However, the general feeling, Mehrav, is in amongst the anti-Netanyahu camp, or some people might call it the liberal camp in Israel, there's a general feeling that this time things are a little bit different. People are fed up, and there are even many initiatives that you can read in the media that are talking about, you know, forming some kind of self-government in different areas and regions within Israel. And the question here is, do you feel, you know, not only that, but, you know, we've started to hear a lot of terms that come from my world, from political science, you know, many experts calling Israel all of a sudden an illiberal democracy. Some people even going as far as calling Israel a theocracy, even or as countries starting to become a theocracy. And so this begs the question: do you feel that the results of this election are truly different than past elections? I mean, after all, this is going to be Netanyahu's sixth government. He's formed government six different times already. What makes the results of this election different from other Netanyahu victories, in your opinion?
Hi, everybody. Thanks, there. So there's a few things to unpack in your question. You asked a lot of things. I think, first of all, to make very clear, this election, you know, created a government that is much more far right than previous governments. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to do everything that they're claiming to do, but it is important to understand that the religious Zionism faction headed by Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, together with the Noam Party, received the third largest number of votes in the Knesset. That's a big deal. And I think, you know, one of my main takeaways is that Itamar Ben-Gvir is, you know, a radical settler who I have run into many times in the West Bank in the years that I was more active, and I've seen him around, and to see somebody like that in the Knesset and about to become what is apparently going to be the new national security minister role is a big deal. So it's important to understand that, you know, there is definitely a much more far-right government, and that's a big deal. At the same time, this is a culmination of years and years in which the settler right has has dictated the agenda in Israel, in which Netanyahu himself, and we can get into this later, has been the leader of anti-democratic processes and legislation and incitement against Palestinians and incitement against the left. So it's important to keep those two things in mind, right? There's nothing new about all the issues that are coming up. Supreme Court being subject to politics, that's not new. Ayelet Shaked has been working on that for years, right? So there's many examples that we can get into, but it's important to understand that it's something that couldn't have, this election couldn't have gone the way it did if there weren't years and years and years of building this and of a rightward shift in general in Israel. At the same time, like I said, that this is new in the sense that these are explicit settler, religious, ultra-nationalist, and even messianic politicians who don't seem to be very concerned about what America's going to think about it or how this is going to create chaos in the military command unit, you know, as far as Bezalel Smotrich's position. So there's a lot to unpack there. I'll stop here and see how we progress with the conversation. But, I think as far as what you said about people wanting to leave, I mean, that has been a trend in Israel for quite a long time, and a lot of people have left. And in this, religious and right wing Jewish Israelis tend to have more babies, but also Israeli left wing secular liberals tend to leave more. So there's both of those processes happening as well.
And Sally, being on the ground, your organization Standing Together is really one of those main grassroots organizations that you truly find, on the ground fighting these fights against anti-democratic trends. How do you feel about this? Do you feel that this is truly different or you guys have been dealing with anti-Netanyahu policies, with combating Netanyahu's policies, whether in the economic realm with, raising the minimum wage or more inclusion of minorities, whether it's ethnic minorities, sexual orientation minorities, all these different communities. Do you feel that this election 2022 and this new Netanyahu government is truly different than, some of the kind of coalitions that you had to face in the past? Or do you feel that this may be a little bit more exaggerated in your opinion?
I'm going to be there. Thank you, first of all. I'm going to be one of those panelists that's just going to say what I want to say. Not because I just want to correct your framing. You said the losing side. And I really think we need to ask ourselves, who's the losing side, right? Like, who are we isolating? Is it the left in Israel? Is it the Zionist left? Is it the Palestinians? Is it the majority of people that live in Israel? Do we want to isolate ourselves further, which is part of the equation that got us here, right? Isolating ourselves as Palestinians and as Israeli left. And reacting to what really Mirav described as a very systematic, very methodological, well-funded, strategic, plan to actually make this happen. This wasn't just like a paradigm shift overnight. This was, the works of many, many years. And I think it's very important right now to really understand that the losing side is the majority of the people. We're not just talking about, obviously the biggest losers are Palestinians, including us Palestinian citizens of Israel, and mainly Palestinians in the occupied territories. Those are the biggest losers. But we also need to understand that there are other marginalized communities that I think, they are already marginalized, as I said. So again, it's not something that was, it's not going to be completely drastic, the change, but it's definitely going to just probably deteriorate in many ways. And we will find ourselves, unfortunately, not only trying to build a new alternative, but also reacting to a very difficult and very extreme government, which is not ideal. And I think that is something that is changing. And it's not anti-Netanyahu that we're building here. It's really anti-occupation, capitalist agendas that are, really stripping the majority of the people from their economic equality and from, you know, their economic prosperity. We're talking about, you know, so many anti things that are doesn't have to do anything with Netanyahu. He just happened to be someone who led a right populist agenda, actually kind of invented it, if you really look at it, even at the global sphere. And yes, he's a very, very difficult contender. And I do think with that being said, and I'm going to end here, I do think there's an opportunity here. You said what's changed from the other five other Netanyahu governments. I do think that in many ways, he is a little bit more desperate. It's hard to talk about Netanyahu as desperate, right? But, you know, he is creating a government that is going to receive a lot of international criticism. And I do think that's an opportunity for us to capitalize on that, as well as isolate the government, this current extreme government, from the people that voted for it. This is our opportunity to reach those people who haven't had an alternative for so many years, and to actually be able to create that conflict between the Israeli public and this extreme government that will not serve the interest of the people. And it, and we're not just talking about LGBTQ and women's rights and Palestinians. We're talking about housing, and we're talking about, you know, livable wage, and we're talking about the costs of living. And I do think that one of the changes that are actually, well, it's hard to say good, but one of the opportunities that we can capitalize on is creating that conflict between the government and the people.
I agree with you that semantics here are important. And the fact that we keep on calling the other side the anti-Netanyahu or the anti-whatever it is kind of the problem. That the only way we can describe this huge groups of communities or different groups that came together to form this coalition as anti-something is part of the problem, because they need to have an agenda at least that would bring them together. And the lack of an agenda amongst the anti-Netanyahu camp is definitely one of the problems. But Mehrab, let me try here and be a devil's advocate, or maybe represent the view that many in Israel, particularly in what is known in Israel as the moderate right, maybe even some centrists would argue. And that's that Benjamin Netanyahu is probably Israel's most risk-averse prime minister in history. This is a guy who doesn't like wars. He doesn't like peace processes either, but he is the master of the status quo, if I could say so. He's somebody who doesn't really like to see things change. And in that sense, he's probably the greatest ally of those that are worried that Israel is in this, you know, midst of change. I mean, he's going to do everything he possibly can to keep the situation as it is. We know that Netanyahu always likes to have a political party to his left within his government. He likes to be the center of his government. That's why he always had an Ehud Barak or a Tzipi Livni or a Yair Lapid or a Moshe Kahlon. He does not have that in this current government, but he would more than love to have Benny Gantz, for example. So, I mean, again, aren't we maybe a little bit exaggerating the fears here? After all, this is Mr. Status Quo here. He's going to try very hard to keep things the way they are. Or are we still, am I still underestimating what is happening here? That no, this is actually more dangerous than other governments.
Well, I would say two things. One, we haven't said yet Netanyahu is on trial for corruption. And, you know, the fact that even though legally he can still serve as prime minister, that already undermines so much of what law and order and democracy, how they're understood in this country. And other prime ministers who have had even just charges against them have withdrawn, and he's done the opposite. He's doubled down. And that makes him extremely dangerous and extremely, like what Sally said, he's desperate. What's going on in this coalition is that he's desperate to get it up and running so that he can, under all understandings from anybody, including the Likud, to get rid of his tribe. I mean, it's not hidden. He wants to change the law to somehow circumvent his trial. And then once he does that, who knows? He might throw out Itamar Ben-Gvir and the others and try to get somebody else in. I don't want to, you know, predict, because I don't know what's going to happen, but that makes it very dangerous. I'm totally losing track of what the other thing I wanted to say was. Remind me remind me what you were asking, and then I'll tell you because it was important. You're on mute.
Thank you for that. No, I was just trying.
The status quo guy. Yes. So I would completely challenge that argument. I would say that no, Netanyahu was not Mr. Status Quo at all. Sure, maybe he hasn't gone on crazy, you know, he didn't do what Sharon did, which was, you know, a big deal when he withdrew from Gaza. But he went to war in Gaza in 2014. He didn't have to do that. That was huge. That was the most fatalities in Gaza ever. He oversaw the Jewish nation state law, which is the, you know, basically just enshrining Jewish supremacy in Israel. He's not Mr. Status Quo. It's actually because of Netanyahu that it's due to many factors, but he has really been the leader to solidify what I think is the road to apartheid, the killing of the two-state solution, the complete annihilation of Palestinian nationalist rights or self-determination as a concept inside Israeli Jewish discourse. So I don't accept that he's Mr. Status Quo. I think he's done a very good job of being calculated and containing when necessary. And he does that to serve his own interests. And he's very good at doing that. And he's an excellent politician. But he's actually moved the status quo in Israel. He's when we talk about status quo, we all say it's not stagnant, because as we know, he has accelerated Israel's control over the West Bank and done many, many other things inside Israel and in the occupied territories. So I don't accept that he's Mr. Status Quo. And I think at this point in his career, which this is probably going to be his last run, both because of his age and because of the situation, I think he's going all in to try to leave whatever legacy he can. I don't know if that means in Iran. I don't know if that means annexing part of the West Bank, but he wants to go all in. He wants to leave a legacy. And I think this is him at his most dangerous.
I'll just comment on the age thing, since you said his age is probably one of the reasons why this will be his last.
I know his dad died really late.
Well, his dad died at the age of 101, I believe. His mom lived to
90. I did not know that.
It's also worth mentioning that Shimon Peres remained in politics till the age of 94. Yitzhak Rabin was killed at the age of 74. Yitzhak Shamir stayed in the Knesset till 96, which was well into his 80s. So, I mean, Netanyahu maybe has still a lot more time left. So,
good point. We'll
have to wait and see.
I do want to add one thing about the changes. You know, we are talking a lot of, you know, big political changes. I do want to talk, you know, from the grassroots level. We already are seeing it. You know, there is going to be changes. We're already feeling them. We organize students on campuses. We already see there's this almost like legitimization. Like there's always have been legitimization for racism and for you know, incitement against the Palestinian students and leftist. You know, whatever. You know, just being leftist is almost as bad nowadays. And you can see that it is really increasingly more legitimized. It's increasingly more safe for these kind of voices to be voiced out, especially on these critical meet points, such as campuses. We are seeing it on the ground, you know, even the police, you know, our cultural events, our anything that we would do, you know, even Palestinian movies, Palestinian artists, we are already seeing a much more difficult way, and we're anticipating a much more difficult times to navigate and to actually create safe spaces for our kind of work. It will necessarily, you know, mean that we will have to put much more resources into, you know, ensuring, you know, that we are safe, you know, physically and legally, and not persecuted. And it's definitely, you know, we feel it. It's very tangible, and we are anticipating for us as a movement, as well as our ecosystem, you know, our shared society, anti-occupation organizations, peace organizations, shared society, democratic, you know, promoting NGOs. It's definitely going to be harder for us, and it's real.
No, thank you for that, Sally, because that's a good segue for me to ask you about my next question. Since you mentioned students and student activism, that is an issue that you guys in Standing Together have been working on, and that's the young vote, so to speak. Roughly, according to estimates, roughly 20% of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich's votes came from soldiers in the army, soldiers being usually younger people. They did well amongst first-time voters in Israel, and young voters in their 20s as well. And this goes this is the opposite trend of what happens, at least in liberal democracies and even in illiberal democracies. And I mean, if you look at data from the elections in places like Hungary and Turkey, you also see that in these places, youngsters voted against the authoritarian leaders of their countries. But for some reason in Israel, it's the other way around. The right and even the far right is very popular with younger voters. We saw parties such as Meretz and Labor receive abysmal results amongst youngsters, especially outside of the urban areas of Tel Aviv and Haifa. And in your opinion, Sally, I mean, how do you explain this phenomenon? And what are the progressive forces in Israel doing wrong? What needs to be done to overcome these really horrible results, if you ask me, amongst young voters?
I love this question. I don't think that Israeli youth is bright on every aspect. If you really look at the results of many, polls, if you ask people about, I think that the notion of what is right in Israel has become very exclusive to pro-security or pro-peace. And pro-peace has been completely distorted, completely ruined, and it doesn't have any kind of competitive edge to the pro-security right populist talk, which is why it has won. And I'll talk a little about that in a little bit. But if you really ask people in our minimum wage campaign, for example, we pulled people and all the young people, we had 87% of people in favor of increasing minimum wage. If you ask people about housing, subsidized housing, public housing, they're all in favor. If you ask people about taxations, if you ask people about, leftist progressive issues, they are more to the left than you would think. Now, why are people right, and are more affiliated with right-wing governments is because right-wing government at the moment is more of a political, as I said, pro-security. They monopolized basically the most human need, which is security. And we can really talk about that more, but it's obvious that, as I said before, the right has worked very methodologically and strategically to basically build that story and be very relevant to young people, which is why they affiliate with the right. And that's what takes me to the left and what they did wrong. If you really look at the Israeli left in the last elections, I'm not even going to talk about the last two decades, which is really what has been happening. The last two decades, if you really look at the left, there has not been one proactive, relevant campaign about people's lives. If you really look at the last elections, where do you see the face of Mirav Mikhaeli and Zehava Gilaon? In Tel Aviv. Okay, if you go to the peripheries, if you go to the geographical and social peripheries of the Israeli society, you don't see Avuda, you don't see Meretz, you don't see, many of the leftist or center left parties that are contending to get popular. They gave up on popular, votes and really got stuck on their liberal base of, secular Tel Aviv and really isolating themselves, as I really mentioned before. And I do think that that's one of the biggest mistakes that the left has done and that the right has done very, very well with their very powerful political story of Jewish supremacy. Because what is security after all? It's really, monopoly over violence to ensure Jewish security. And I do think that we need to create a new political story that can compete with that, that talks about security as necessarily as a product of ending the occupation and of peace and of, you know, income security and domestic security and house security and all of these things. And it needs to happen while engaging the peripheries geographically and socially.
Interesting. Mehrab, you, as a journalist, you've also covered the occupied territories. Would you agree with Sally that, you know, the fall of the left amongst younger voters is mainly a result of elitist urban, you know, metropolitan attachments that they feel disassociated with the periphery? Or is it more of the occupation that, you know, moves people, especially younger people who serve in the military, to the right? Or is it a mixture of both? Or is there something here that we're missing? How would you explain these results that really go against the trend in the entire world of younger voters voting with the right and even the far right?
Well, I mean, of course, what Sally is saying is right. And, you know, Meretz has had this problem for a long time. But, you know, it is also important to remember that the way that the parliamentary election ran, it could have easily gone to the other side. Now, the other side is not left wing by any means, but the anti-Netanyahu camp could have won. I'm not going to go into all the, you know, but it basically the smaller parties and people who lost their votes because they didn't reach the threshold, if they had joined together, strategically speaking, they could have worked. And that's also a big problem of the left, that they don't know how to work together. The right works together very well, even if they have differences. The right-wing coalition we see now has tons of differences, at least on some level. So that's part of it. But you know, it's not just the occupation. I mean, I think it's the fact that there's been no vision. If we're talking specifically on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the two-state solution has just been dangling like a word for decades now, and the left has had no vision for what the solution for a conflict, and also in lieu of a solution, what should be done, right? So that's where human rights groups have mostly come in, that we need to, on the ground now, do something about the injustices because we're not able to push public opinion one way or another. And I think most Israelis, including the ones in Tel Aviv who are very liberal and very secular, don't care about what happens in the West Bank because it doesn't affect them directly. So that's a huge challenge. There's a huge, you know, majority in the center that it's just not something that interests them. And the Israeli left has not figured out how to harness them. And let's be honest, Israel doesn't pay any price for what it does. And that's really on the international community in general and the US specifically. The US is just as responsible for what's happening today in Israel. The far right could not have won the way it did, and Netanyahu would not have moved to work with these far right radicals if the US didn't give tons of green lights over the course of the last decade that it can just do what it wants and not pay a price. You know, that's realpolitik, you know? So, I mean, it's all of those things. And I think the fact that Meretz and the Labour Party went into the Lapid-Bennett government, I understand why they did it. But if you look at what the Lapid-Bennett government did, it was the same on Palestinians. It was even worse. They outlawed six Palestinian NGOs. They've been killing more Palestinians, you know, than in years past. So Meretz, you know, that's on them. That's on Avodah and on Meretz. The laws that they voted for, the fact that they decided to go all in. Now, it doesn't mean that they didn't do great things. It doesn't mean that maybe they prevented an even worse government. But the fact is that they have compromised on their most basic, minimum platforms for too long.
Right, but that actually, your argument here of what they've done brings me to the, well, what should be done question. And that is that at the end of the day, Netanyahu has a strong and cohesive coalition. Generally speaking, despite the many differences, and while it doesn't look like it right now, but there are in Likud voices that, at least in Israeli, relative Israeli terms, are considered maybe liberal or even secular, even though they're not at the center stage right now. There is this feeling that they are one group, that they are this cohesive group. While on the other hand, you have a coalition that stretches from, you know, anti-Zionist Arab parties all the way to the New Hope, Gideon Saar's New Hope Party, which is actually on many issues, particularly the occupation, probably even more right-wing than Netanyahu's party. They originate from the Tikhia movement from the 1980s, which was to Likud's right wing. And the Netanyahu camp is so cohesive that they can basically pass any legislation that they want. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk in Israel now about, for example, the override clause, which many people fear would be the beginning of this anti-democratic or this, you know, authoritarian intrusion into politics. So just very quickly, the override clause, and you can talk about it, Mehrab and Sal, if you want, is basically this decision that would render the Israeli courts, the return Israeli court rulings basically into recommendations, right? Where Israeli courts would rule something, but you know, if the Knesset does not like the ruling, then with a simple majority, and they still haven't decided if it's gonna be a simple majority of 61 or more, but with a simple majority, the Knesset can override the Supreme Court's decision, rendering the Supreme Court to be basically this institution that gives only recommendations. This is especially dangerous in Israel's case because Israel is a country without a constitution, as we know. So, I mean, imagine an extreme case where, for example, the Knesset decides to outlaw Arab parties, for example, under any excuse whatsoever. The Supreme Court, which usually does not allow such a thing to happen, now won't have the power to prevent them from doing so. Or if they want to take away more rights from the LGBTQ plus community, for example, again, the Supreme Court won't be able to protect that minority, and so on and so forth. So basically my question, Mehrab, here is, what should be done to oppose these potentially anti-democratic legislations, especially when you have this opposition that really has nothing in common together? How are we going to bring Lieberman with Chadash and all these and everyone in between to come and work cohesively together against this new coalition?
I mean, so some of the legislative changes that we're seeing being pushed now through the Knesset as quickly as possible in order for this coalition to get up and running, you know, not just the judiciary, also the Ben-Gvir law, the Smotrich law, that all has to do with expanding authorities in order for them to push their agenda more freely. These are all very, very disconcerting. They have a majority to pass these laws. I don't know, you know, if there is something that can be done to stop them in the halls of Knesset. I know that there's things that can be done outside in the streets. And I think that's where this is going to have to happen. And we've seen, the government isn't even sworn in yet. There is no coalition yet. And already we're seeing so much opposition inside Israel and outside Israel. And so the question is, what are these forces going to do? And how far are they willing to go? I think that, you know, Netanyahu, for his own interest of stability, is going to have to be very careful. He's going to probably do what he can to keep things much more calculated in the way these things happen. You know, there's a lot being thrown around, a lot of threats of a lot of different laws. And, you know, in Israel, this happens a lot where they threaten to do a lot. And then when the law actually passes, it's watered down and it's much less horrifying than it originally was done. But the impact is the same. The impact is a chilling effect that creates huge amount of fear and intimidation on the ground. And that's really where the people have to come in to do something about it. So, you know, there's everything from the Israel Bar Association head to the Supreme Court president to attorney general. Everybody is warning that this horrible impending thing is about to happen. Whether or not it will happen the way we think it will or how, that we don't know right now. But it's clear that, you know, also the military. I mean, if we get into the Smotrich Ben-Gvir stuff at all, I don't know if we have time, but you know, they're also the military. They're basically inciting against the authority of the IDF chief of staff. There's like, if you didn't think Israel could be even further to the right, it's going even further right. It's inciting against the military. I mean, so we're seeing like no rock bottom to where this can go. And I think it's very important to remember that a lot of the anti-democratic, trends that we're seeing there. I think we should be just as worried about what's happening outside the Knesset as what's happening inside the Knesset. And, you know, and I also just want to point out that democracy is a spectrum. At no point in time will I say now Israel is not a democracy. I mean, it's arguable whether Israel is currently a democracy. I would say that it's in the current, first of all, it's always been an ethnocracy because it's always prioritized Jewish rights. That's just, you know, a political definition that works. But it's the sovereign of everywhere between the river and the sea. So, I mean, you know, not to knock on the webinar, but the title of the webinar, the question is already flawed, right? And we have to look at this as a spectrum, and we have to keep in mind that things always seem worse than they are. And there's a lot of things that can be done. But in this specific scenario, they're probably going to pass a lot of these laws. Again, a little bit more watered down than what we see. Even the Ben-Gvir law now is a bit more watered down. I don't know if he'll have all of the powers over the police that he wants, but I do know that the vibe on the street is already so charged, and you don't even need to change the law for there to be friction between the police and Palestinian citizens of Israel. Look at what happened a year and a half ago. So I think this is what to keep in mind. I'll stop here.
And Sally, I mean, nobody has more experience of bringing different communities that at face value don't have much in common with each other and bringing them together to work with one another more than standing together. So based on your expertise, how would you recommend to the political leadership in Israel of the anti-Netanyahu camp, the liberal camp, the government of change, as it's known, a very bad translation from Hebrew, How would you recommend for these different, very different factions to come together? Is there an agenda that can unite all these different groups that they can come and cooperate with each other on, or is it a lost cause?
I wouldn't say it's a lost cause. I do think that we're already seeing, you know, a lot of panic, you know, a lot of threats and a lot of panic, and people are just reacting to like the million things. I think it's happened also a lot of our American audience will relate to this when Trump, you know, got in power, he was elected and he was like starting to talking about so many things. And there were like kids in the borders in Texas, you know, who are like put in cages. There's like things about the medical insurance. There's so many like different, he's just like blatant racism and so many threats, and people were reacting. But at the same time, you also need to understand that we will probably lose many of the fights. I do agree with Mirab that I don't think, maybe that's just wishful hope. How do you say it? Hopeful, wishful hoping? Is that how you say it? Wishful thinking. I do think that many of them will not be as bad as they seem right now. I do think that Netanyahu also has an interest in keeping things, you know, at the just like pushing the limit until a certain level where he maintains some kind of legitimacy, globally and, you know, publicly within Israel. And we will react. The question is, how do we react and how do we absorb this energy of resistance of these new policies into creating, not only reacting to the current situation and to their conversation that they are dictating, but actually trying to create an alternative. I feel like I'm a broken record, but we really need to, you know, we really need to understand that we will probably lose many of the fights, but we need to create our own fights against them. We need to put them on the defense. And I know that we are right now at a very defensive side because we feel we lost. We need to understand that we have the power, we have the infrastructure on the grassroots level to actually put them on the defense. And I do think that many of the things, the bad things that will happen, that we will probably lose, will actually also be an opportunity for us to create momentum, to create energy, to create resistance on the ground, to actually try and build an alternative as well, an alternative vision from the one that we have at the moment. And unfortunately, I don't see that happening in the Knesset at the moment. I don't think there is a lot of the kind of politics that I'm talking about, that we are envisioning, that really envisions a new majority, that envisions this kind of politics. And that's okay, you know, it's not ideal, but I do think that grassroots has a very, very powerful tools to actually make things, build things within 4 years until the next elections. Absolutely.
I mean, hope is something important to hold on to, without a doubt.
Very difficult thing to hold on to. Very yeah. difficult thing, but...
And difficult as well, without a doubt. I know, that, I know that we don't have a lot of time left. We have to give a Q&A sometime. So I just wanted to ask both of you very quickly, if there's just one issue or the main issue that both of you feel will be the number one issue to deal with in the next government. Since there are many threats that have been talked about, threats to democracy in Israel, but if there's one issue that you're worried about the most, or you feel that we must all organize against more than other issues, what would that one issue be? Or is there simply more than one issue? And whoever wants to go first.
There's more than one issue, but I mean, it really depends what level you're looking at it, right? But I'll just say, from my perspective, you know, in my job, I think the Temple Mount and East Jerusalem are huge, and Area C of the West Bank. There's going to be, I think, a lot more destruction, demolition, expulsion, killing. And, you know, we don't need to go that far in the past to see where that goes. So those two areas, if I had to choose.
Sally?
I think the big question that actually Ben-Gvir posed in the last elections is, who's the landlord, right? He actually, that was his campaign, kilo mi bala bait, who's the landlord of this homeland? And I think the biggest message that we need to give right now, which is, you know, which translates to so many different things, is that we share this homeland. This is very general, but I do think it's a very powerful message that we need to understand how we translated into different aspects, you know, and how this political story of a shared, you know, we are all landlords. And this is the one thing that really would translate to the different areas in Israeli society, as well as in the occupied territories.
And just to add to what Sally was saying, the Negev, the Bedouin communities in the Negev, the South, the Nakab, that's also a huge area. If you have to look geographically at the places that could become the most combustible, I would also look there.
That's also what I wanted to mention to the viewers of this webinar. Keep a special eye on the Negev, the Nakab, Southern Israel, the tensions there. A large portion, one of the reasons why Ben-Gvir's campaign was so successful was, on the one hand, the feeling of insecurity among many in the Jewish community there, but also the deep grievances that the Palestinian Bedouins in the Negev have are also pretty big. The discrimination that community suffers from is enormous. So I'm personally, as somebody who lived in Be'er Sheva in the past, That's the place that probably worries me more than any other. Not to say that all the other things obviously also worry me very much. Obviously, we can go on and on for hours on this, but we also need to give people here, and we've gotten a lot of very good questions for you guys. So a number of questions here, and I might botch some names, so I apologize for that, but here are two easier names. David Abraham and Jeffrey Lewis have asked about this. In one way or another, and that's, what can we as Americans or American Jews do to support Israel, our Palestinian Israelis, the Jewish left in Israel? What can folks here in the United States or supporters of a more progressive and enlightened Israel do from abroad to help? Sally, since your mic is open, if you want to go first.
I think the first thing that you need to do is exactly what you're doing right now, which I'm very grateful for, just taking the time to actually listen to it's to the complex, you know, situation, but also listen from people who are, you know, very, very involved on the ground. I think it's very important. Like in Israel, I do think that in the US as well, a lot of the conversation is binary, is that dichotomy of, you know, you either need to be pro-Israel or you are, you know, pro-Palestine. And I do think that especially now with this new government, which is another opportunity, I see it really has highlighted the fact that, you know, it doesn't work like that. You need to be pro the people that live here. And I do think that I truly deeply believe that we all, you know, share the interest in peace and in a social and equal, in a just and equal society. And especially now, I think it highlights the conversation that I think you need to take to your communities. And I'm always, I saw the question, and it also talks specifically about the Jewish communities. Part of my work is you know, working with the Jewish communities in the US, and I'm always like amazed of how organized it is. And it's like, you've already done the job, but, you know, we just need to actually create the right message and actually bring it forward. And that message is that if you are pro-Israel, you're necessarily pro-Palestinian liberation and vice versa. And that's the message that needs to be done. And just reach out to us, be updated on what we do and amplify the messages of the people on the ground. And honestly, there's also a lot of things that you can do abroad to impact the conversation. And I'm more than, you know, there's a lot that I can say about it, but we are really trying to find a model that can amplify our work and our messaging into that conversation abroad in the US, especially. That can actually be impactful and help us. And I'm actually sharing, you're welcome to just to get updates from Standing Together, and you can reach out to us as well. And we're more than happy to always collaborate. We really see this as, you know, a collaboration.
All right. Just before we go to Mirav, David mentioned to me that it's not only American Jews who are worried, but also people in Canada are worried. And I just wanted to make that clear. That comment on my part was in no way to support some kind of American supremacy here. Canada is also important. Everybody's
important. We're all faulty of that. I apologize.
I was just reading the question, which mentioned American Jews in that sense. Mirav, what do you think supporters of a more progressive Israel can do from abroad?
Elect a more progressive president. No, but I mean, the U.S. policy has to change. So that's the work can be done there to get that done. And, the Democrats that are doing that are up against a lot. So that's one aspect. I mean, people know this, but it's not easy. But continuing to work to get the U.S. to not exceptionalize Israel on foreign policy, it's difficult, and the U.S. has its own interests in doing so, but that's one major one. And the other one, to be very brief, is donate to Palestinian civil society. Like, give your money to Palestinian organizations.
Another question here, and we didn't get to this enough. And Sally, you have a comment here that you might want to look at about contact info and whatnot. And that has to do with violence and terrorism on the Palestinian side as well. And Mirav, you have a lot of experience on this. Palestinian violence and Palestinian terrorism does not really help the progressive cause in Israel. We've seen that in the past. We've also seen it in the past year as well. How can these two things be bridged together? How can you get the Israeli public interested in talks on peace and moving forward with the peace process or ending the occupation when you have so much violence against Israelis as well? Does the left need to talk more about this issue? Does it need to be more firm? This is an argument that you hear many centrists, especially when you ask them, well, why aren't you considering to vote for Meretz or Labor? Oh, they're weak on terrorism. That's one of the comments that you usually hear. Do you agree with that sentiment, or are we looking at it, you know, maybe not in the correct manner? What do you think?
I mean, the question on Palestinian terror is not really relevant to the question of Israeli democracy, but I understand why it's asked. It's certainly something that we can get into. There is a conflict. Israel, however, is the strongest military power in the Middle East. There's plenty to be said about not only Palestinian terror, what is terror, what is Israeli terror? You know, this word is something that I think needs to be broken down. The fact that the Israeli left hasn't been able to provide a good response to how to deal with Palestinian violence, That's clear, but we don't talk enough about Israeli violence and what that looks like, and when it's state sanctioned violence. So there aren't enough minutes for me to get into all of this. So I can't really do that. I'm happy to do that in another webinar. I can say that speaking with my hat as an analyst with a crisis group, which I wasn't doing for this webinar, I can say that there are some major issues that we deal with. One is Israeli lack of accountability and impunity. The other is the abdication of responsibility by the international community. And the third is the issue of Palestinian legitimacy. Legitimacy meaning the fact that their own leadership is corrupt, the fact that they haven't been able to organize themselves properly for various reasons, not also Israeli occupation, also their own inability to organize. And all that leads to a lot of desperation. And when you talk about Palestinian terror, I'll just say one more thing. You have to remember that these are people who have no recourse. When they boycott, they're violent. When they, no matter what they do, they're violent. So, nobody condones violence or terror, but it's just too simplistic to talk about it in those terms.
I couldn't put it any better than that, Mirav. Thank you. Appreciate your answer, really, truly.
Okay. So we don't have a lot of time left now, but I just wanted to ask both of you, based on your experiences coming from two different fields, how long do you think this government will last? I mean, the last time we had a government that lasted for more than 16 months was back in from 2015 to 2019. How long do you see this current Netanyahu government? Will it survive its 4 years like Netanyahu promises, or do you think we'll revert back to the political crisis and the instability that we've been living in sooner rather than later? Again, Sally, since your mic is open, I'm going to begin with you.
I don't think I'm in a position as an activist to predict. I really don't know. Looking at other examples, historically and currently, I'm hoping that we will be able to do things right to create the critical mass to block a similar government in the next round. I do, unfortunately, think it is a stable enough government for the next 4 years. But again, disclaimer, not an expert.
You're muted.
Of course, I keep on falling for that. One issue that we didn't talk enough about, because there's so many issues to talk about here, and we'll just do this very quickly, is to talk about Israel's Palestinian minority, the Palestinian Israelis or the Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel. Do you guys expect a change? We already talked a little bit about the Negev and the Nakba, especially that's where Ben-Gvir had a lot of his focus during his campaign. But do you guys expect any serious change when it comes to policies regarding Israel's largest minority? Or is it going to be more of the same? Because to be honest, we didn't, with maybe some, maybe in the economic realm, we saw some changes during the Bennett-Lapid government, where there was more government investment and that was mainly on paper, it never materialized, but there wasn't any real change there. Do you guys expect this government to deteriorate the situation even more? Or are we going to see, you know, the same old policies of, you know, discrimination and incitement on the one hand, but more investment in the Arab community in Israel simply because it's in Israel's economic interest to invest economically there? Since, you know, Arab citizens of Israel are generally younger, they're more in the labor market, especially when you have the problems with the Haredim entering the labor market, you need more Arabs working, et cetera, et cetera. So do you guys see a deterioration in that sector, or is it gonna be more of the same? And this is the final question, sorry.
Yeah, real quick. I know that we're up for, you know, the end of the program. Two things. One, I do unfortunately expect more deteriorating in terms of political arrests. We saw that, but we saw that already in May, last May of 2021. We saw political persecution. We saw political arrests. We saw two guys, you know, who are imprisoned for like 7-10 years now, you know, for their involvement. You know, and I do think that it will, they were kind of an example of don't do that. I do think that we will see more and more persecution, but it doesn't necessarily have to do just with this government. You know, I do think it also has to do with some kind of the national awakening that we're seeing of Palestinians in Israel, Palestinian youth that are no longer, you know, that are more politicized. And yes, they are also more integrated than ever in the Israeli economy, in the Israeli society. They are more educated than ever. They speak fluent Hebrew more than ever. They are more connected, you know, internationally as well with the West Bank, with Gaza, with the Palestinians, you know, outside of Israel, Palestine. And you really see, you know, this awakening. And I do think that we will see increased level of attempts to suppress that, unfortunately. I definitely see that.
And I'll just add really quickly to close that, you know, I think that the biggest difference with this new coalition is that the far right sees Palestinian citizens of Israel as enemies, you know, by and large, that they put a target on them. They are not part of... certainly not part of the Jewish community, that's obvious, but not part of, I mean, they're just not part of the body politic as far as they're concerned. So that's a very dangerous situation, no matter what laws are passed or not passed, that just the fact that they are in such high levels of power is going to create a lot of chaos and violence.
And with that pessimistic view of chaos and violence, it's time to bring this conversation to an end. Thank you for joining us today. Let me just hand things back to Ron for some closing remarks, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Thayer, Sally, Mirav. Yeah, I agree. Speaking personally, it really is a time for the need for alternatives, new narratives, in order to deal with the dangers before us, whether they happen quickly or more gradually. I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. I want to thank Dinesh Sharma of Partners for Progressive Israel, who you haven't seen on the webinar, but has been working tirelessly behind the scenes to make this discussion happen. We hope everyone enjoyed, I don't know if enjoyed the webinar is the word, but benefited and came out more educated from the webinar. Just for those who missed the opening, I'll just mention that the last two sessions of Partners for Progressive Israel's Israel-Palestine Symposium, those are online sessions, will be on January 8th, and they'll be on the question of human rights education and miseducation, and where do we go from here? What is there for us to do? Which is something that the panelists were addressing during the webinar. Last but not least, the program's been free. But the organization really appreciates generous contributions to enable it to deliver these events at no cost. So if you're able, progressiveisrael.org, and you know what to do from there, and also check out other offerings on the website. So thank you, everyone. Stay informed. Chag Sameach. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy holiday season. And hope to see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Pleasure.
Thank you.